I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
And welcome to the Shakti Hour, a podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm your host, Melanie Moser, and today I am delighted to share a really fun chat with the beautiful Trudy Goodman. You'll have to indulge me here. There's a bunch of ambient sound on this recording as there was a difficulty with the internet, and I really wanted to talk to Trudy right away. And so we just went for it. And I think that the energy, the vibe, the content, the feeling is strong enough to override any audio distractions. I really, really liked talking with her, and I'm super happy to have been connected with her through the Ram Dass Satsang and to look forward to getting to spend some time with her in person and participate, hopefully, with Inside LA and some other things that she's got going on up at Spirit Rock over the summer. Please do remember to subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. You can follow along at BeHereNowNetwork.com, Shakti Hour on Twitter, and the Shakti Hour podcast on Instagram. I'm going to be going back to the Shakti Sacred Music Series in the coming months, so stay tuned for that. You can catch up on those episodes at ShaktiSacredMusic.com, and you can also follow along at Patreon/ShaktiHour if you want to catch some unedited conversations from that series, along with additional reflections from me and special meditation offerings. Thank you so much for listening to the Shakti Hour, and here we are now with Trudy Goodman. So I'm here today with the beautiful Trudy Goodman, and Trudy and I are just meeting over the internet for the first time, although I have listened to your talks and seen you in the videos of the Ram Dass retreats. So what I'd like to start with you today, actually, is the word Dharma. I would just love to hear, for two reasons. I'd love to hear your reflections as a teacher on the word Dharma, but then also I'd love to hear kind of how your Dharma has unfolded and how you've come to the seat of teacher today. So it's a two-part kind of question for you.
I'm just curious for you, what is it about the general question about Dharma that you're really interested in? Because it's a pretty big question.
Yeah, you know, it really is a big question. And I think I just have been, you know, a little skeptical of the secret or this desire for purpose, people wanting their purpose and having to have this, you know, capital letters, you know, next to their name, and this is what I do, and this is who I am, and this is what I'm here for. And so I've just been kind of And so there's that aspect of it, right? There's the personal purpose, kind of the Oprah Winfrey angle, right? And then there's the spiritual aspect of it, which is just basically, you know, your spiritual practice, your embodiment of this life, right? So I guess I'm kind of just like looking at those two culturally, maybe totally misunderstood aspects of the word, and also trying to, you know, reckon with how non-negotiable it is personally.
Okay. Well, let's see. So, you know, in the tradition that I'm formed by and have practiced in, which is Buddhist meditation, and I've actually done primarily, I think, the early years, about 15 years as a Zen student, and then Vipassana insight meditation, but also a few years of study in the Tibetan tradition, because I was just so curious about each tradition. And so in the Buddhist tradition, Dharma has several meanings, and it means, it refers to the teachings of the Buddha, like the actual teachings, what they are. And also this, it has a meaning that's more universal, like the laws of nature. For example, simple things, like when I talk to kids about it, I would say the fact that the trees grow up and not down, or that the waves roll in to the beach and not out, you know, just laws of nature.
So gravity, natural law, like, yeah, the natural law.
Exactly. And the teachings, the natural law, and then one's dharma, one's truth, or how we embody the teachings. I think that's also what you're asking about and are curious about. And of course, that's where the rubber meets the road, is what we actually do with the teachings. And what I love, I mean, when I love the word practice, which I don't know if that word gets used as much in other spiritual contexts or religions, but I love the word practice because I was a psychotherapist and we talked about our therapy practice, and it had a similar meaning in terms of developing skills and knowledge and studying and trying to become the best therapist that we could be, really master our craft, our profession. And and there isn't really, I mean, of course, that can be endlessly refined. And it's the same thing. The Dharma refers also to our practice, the practice that we do over and over again, the practice of meditation, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of self-compassion, developing more and more of our character in line with the teachings, which are about love and understanding and compassion. So how to, you know, we practice through sitting every day, through looking deeply into our own hearts, through being honest about what we see. And sometimes I think that's the definition of mindfulness that I like the best, is just a kind of clarity or honesty.
Right. And so, so this is great. And I know there's more coming, but I just want to pick up your word of practice that you're highlighting, and I think that that's maybe where, personally or culturally even, this idea of purpose versus dharma or kind of is become part of capitalism, versus you're talking about we practice the dharma, meaning we practice cultivating these characteristics within ourselves.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
That then we take to our purpose, our path, our world. Yeah.
Our world of relationships, our work, our everything that we do, hopefully, you know, hopefully we're kinder to people. And, you know, I was teaching recently with a dear friend who is a Tibetan Buddhist, Rinpoche, and he was talking about all the years and years of practice that he did. And he said, in some ways I was missing the point. I mean, he started when he was 12 years old, so his understanding has evolved. But he said, in some ways I was missing the point, which was just to be kinder, just to see, you know, is this making me kinder? And I was thinking about how when we were young and we all started, you know, launched ourselves into these practices with great enthusiasm and passion. And if somebody had said to me, you know, you're really doing this so that you could be a more loving and kind person, I would have thought, well, that's nice. But actually what I really want is enlightenment, altered states of consciousness. What is reality anyway? You know, these other kinds of questions. But in fact, it's so much, it turns out that ultimate reality and these deeper understandings of what this is that we're involved in here as human beings, that really the question of kindness, it mirrors to me a sort of infinite tenderness that is available in the universe, not the universe of self-branding and self-promoting that I think you're referring to when you were talking about sort of the deterioration of this idea of practice, when it becomes about, more materialistic or commercial things. And now we all have to have a livelihood. We all have to figure out how to support ourselves. And it is tricky to maintain integrity in a field where we talk about you really have to brand yourself. You know, for people in my generation, that's a weird concept. But if you're a millennial, it's the water you're swimming in. You kind of have to do it.
Right. And so this is the value of practice. I there was a little clip on Instagram, speaking of branding, and with Dolly Parton talking, you know, and she was saying in her way about, you know, whatever your dreams are, you have to put every limb, every thought, every you had to put your whole self into the practice of creating your dreams, basically. Right. And so whatever you're practicing, and then as you were saying that practicing, I was reflecting on this past little section of my life where I was practicing, quote unquote, some old conditioned behaviors that were really creating pain, you know, that were really creating problems.
We've all been there.
And I was practicing them and practicing them and practicing them and trying, and it almost felt divided. It felt like two different beings, like a mechanical being that had practiced for so many years doing these things. And then really trying to effort into what I was believing was my dharma. If this makes any sense. So at this point, personally, the old practice overrode the new practice. And so this is where I think, now that we're talking this through, I'm understanding more now that I have seen that happen clearly. I was awake enough to see it happen. Now I see how consequential, how essential practicing the Dharma, practicing your Dharma is in order to live well in the world. So let's go back and just tell me a little bit how you got here. You started to say that you were looking, when you first got into this, you were looking for altered states of consciousness and enlightenment and all these different things. What brought you into a spiritual practice to begin with?
I think what brought me into it to begin with was just sort of what you were describing when the whole thing froze, when we were talking about how you found yourself practicing behaviors or ways of being that didn't bring you happiness. In fact, they were actually causing pain. And it was the same for me. I was really, I was young and I found myself at the ripe old age of 24, a divorced single mom already. And I think this is part of what triggered it was I met a man who was lovely, who was happy to take on my daughter and me. I wasn't really able to make that relationship. And I wound up kind of, it felt like being, I left. And I remember being so perplexed, like, why did I do this? And not really understanding what was driving me. And So I actually started, I wanted to meditate, but I just felt too crazy at that point to sit with myself. So I started psychotherapy. And I was just so lucky because this was like, what, 1972 or something? 1971, I don't even remember, but I was lucky to find a therapist who was already a meditator. What were the chances back then? You know, he was a psychiatrist, whatever. It was just good fortune. And that became my goal, to be able to sit with myself and bear it. And so it's not, you know, I think a lot of us start our spiritual path out of our own suffering. And I think that's such an authentic reason to begin. It's very raw and real. You know, yes, I had taken psychedelics, I had taken LSD, I had had certain visions in the course of those experiments that really showed me there was more to reality than what I had been taught in school and discovered so far. But I would say the thing that propelled me to actually practice, as opposed to read and think about it, but to actually put my body, you know, pretty much what you were saying Dolly Parton was talking about, to really my whole body, my whole heart, my whole mind, to really direct it toward waking up to more of who I really was, who really are each one of us. I think that it was that suffering that propelled me, you know, being perplexed and bewildered and not understanding myself or what I was doing. And
but there's an awakening. There was an awakened part of you that saw what was happening. Do you know where that came from? That noticed that you had done that?
Well, I think everyone has that part. You know, I think we all have that awakened part that deep down does know, and that the mind actually does know, but we can't let ourselves know yet. So I think that is part of our birthright. Each one of us has that. But then I've had some experiences, and this is interesting to you, I think, because as a female, you know, woman, I had had some experiences before I ever heard of Buddhism or thought of spiritual practice in the course of some particularly female experiences, giving birth and almost losing my daughter to an illness, you know, very serious. So I think that I've always treasured the fact that I had these spiritual openings in the context of very ordinary experience as a mom, becoming a mother and then being a mother. Completely ordinary. And yet they were those experiences were maybe the source of also a longing to understand more and have something that could help me integrate all these parts of myself and my experience up until then. I kind of didn't appreciate them at the time for what they were. They were just experiences. I thought, well, everybody has certain experiences when they give birth, or everybody has certain experiences in the stress of almost losing somebody they love. Do you know what I mean? I just thought this is normal. I was too young to know anything really about what other people experience. But I love the fact that it has given me the trust that everybody can experience different kinds of opening or awakening. The fact that it didn't happen through a particular teacher or a particular darshan or a particular, it just happened through the darshan of my life.
Well, but
does that make sense?
I mean, that's exactly it, you know, and I think that that's exactly the meat of the question that I'm struggling with right now. And it does have to be, it does have to do with the miracle of life and creating a being. And I think that if you go through that experience, you said it's an ordinary thing. Well, it's ordinary because it happens all the time, but it's not ordinary. You're faced with the complexity of your body. You're faced with the complexity of the spiritual and physical coming together. You're faced with an undeniable an unbeatable love that clouds your vision to try to see the being that's in front of you as a mother, right? To you simultaneously see every little limb, every little hangnail, and you also can't see the whole being because you also see this great soul, right? You also see this thing. So in a way, I think that that's part of why it's such a joke to consider that it's ordinary in a way, because I have this book on Tibetan parenting, and I don't know how accurate it is. You know, I got it off Amazon. I just searched and it seemed really cool, but there's in that culture, at least as this book says, the man and the woman and the whole family, the whole community gathers around the two people that are coming together then to create. Then there's all these rituals around the spiritual aspect. There's all these rituals around the physical aspects of the earth, the water, the different elements. And there's this whole, you know, communal masculine, feminine integration of that process, not as being ordinary at all, as being quite spectacular, right? And precarious even in how this soul enters into the realm. So, you know, it would make sense to me that as a, you know, quote unquote young mother, you would be resistant to settling down.
Yes.
So psychologically, maybe there was a critique. Why would I run away from this thing? But it makes absolute sense if you're not guided into that process through, you know, when I read this book, you know, it's so many elements, so many people, so much wisdom, so many generations holding a person as they go into that experience. And so is the spiritual path different for men than it is for women? If it's held outside of the making of a new life, then absolutely it is.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what you're drawing attention to, and me too, which is that spiritual life doesn't have to take place in the temple, in the synagogue, in the church, in the ashram, in the, you know, and our relationship to spirit or God or whatever we want to call it, our relationship to that doesn't have to be, we don't need an intermediary in the form of a, often male, at least it used to be, rabbi, priest, minister. We can go direct and have our own experience of the sacred and that which is holy. And I think the other thing you're saying that is so true is that, yes, it's ordinary because it's commonplace, but that if we look deeply, nothing is ordinary. I mean, giving birth is magical and miraculous, of course, the way new life comes in and new life leaves. But at the same time, if we look at, I mean, at one point I picked up my cup and took a sip of water. What is water? Where does it come from? Where does it come from? You know what I mean? We're having a rainy day here in Northern California. Science can describe these phenomena, but they are still miraculous. Yeah. The fact that we live and move and have our being and can love, and this is, what is this? You know, you're right. Nothing is ordinary. And in Zen, there's a saying, ordinary mind is the way. But it's really talking about the extraordinary ordinary, the ordinary, you know, can see the sacred in everything.
So tell me then about how you navigated through these different teachings and teachers to come to where you are now. So you had this kind of psychological awakening around this shift in your personal life.
But then I also had some spiritual awakening in terms of what I went through when I gave birth and what I went through when my daughter was dying in the hospital. And I think those are important because those were glimpses that happened really because out of suffering. I began to see, for example, when she was very ill and she coded and all the doctors came running and the nurses and they were, you know, she was 2 years old, this tiny little body in a hospital bed, and they were all working on her. And I told this story because it was so, it was a real opening where I suddenly, the room, you know, nothing had changed except everything changed. And I really saw, I had the feeling that I was seeing God. And that the people who were working on that little body, that God was not separate from this activity of compassion, trying to save a life, that God was not located somewhere else, whether it's up in the sky or down in the earth or, you know, wherever we might have a story about where the sacred lives. It became so clear to me that it's right here, right now, in the activity of love and compassion. And having seen that, I think that that carried me through a lot of the practices that in some ways might have seemed sort of alien to me as a young woman, like making prostrations to some Asian man who was my meditation teacher. I was a feminist. I thought, what am I doing? You know, putting my forehead on the floor to this guy. But I had some deep trust that I was going to learn something that was not available to me in my own culture, at least not to me. I was born Jewish, but I wasn't raised observant, and you had to learn Hebrew, and that was a big obstacle for me. It wasn't immediately accessible to me, but somehow, you know, you asked what carried me through, and I don't really know, except that I was willing to trust the unknown, and I wanted to learn, and I wanted to explore. And so that not knowing helped me transform my understanding of the things that were just hard that happened in my life, that, you know, having divorce, just the things that happened to us, right, in the course of a life, they helped me understand that these things really were and are karmic purifications when we're doing spiritual practice, that they actually help us see more clearly where we need to grow and what's getting in the way. And I don't make that big of a distinction between psychological and spiritual where that process is concerned.
Correct. Right. Because your telling of that story in the hospital emergency situation, you know, it's very, I get the transmission of that teaching through your telling of that story. And it almost reminds me of the title of one of Jack's books, that After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. Isn't that his book? Yeah. And yeah. In a way where it's almost like when you tell that story, it's like, how do you even go back into the world after that? Like, how do you even, after you've seen God in that way, how do you even go back into the world and continue on, you know? And so in that way, that's the practice there then of Dharma.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. Because we come back from an experience like that and then we're faced with all our stuff that we still have and it doesn't really make it go away or anything. And then it becomes the question of how do I reconcile what I've seen with the actuality of who I am and what my life is. And I think at the beginning, a lot of our practice is kind of idealistic that way. You know, we have a vision or some ideal and we're trying to live up to it or live into it. And then gradually we come to see that we are it. But that takes time. We come to see that we are ourselves, that activity of compassion and love that we call God or spirit or Buddha or, you know, any of the other beautiful names from sacred traditions.
Well, and in that way too, that's also held in that story, that experience too, because why would you want to be? I mean, you were helpless. You had to stand aside and just view it. And that's the truth, right? That's actually the truth of what we're doing here ultimately anyway. So these, so the ego grasping for power, or the, you know, in that moment you are forced to surrender. I had one part that I was telling you about practicing these conditioned behaviors, and it felt like I was racing myself. This is the visual I had. It was like I was running a race, and I was race, the spiritual mind and the conditioned mind were like racing each other. And as soon as I would catch up, I being the awakened I would be like, oh wait, no. You know, I was trying to like, calling people and like, I just understood this. Like, we have to just, you know, I have to tell you this. And, you know, it was a very, frenetic kind of experience where the truth was coming in as fast as I was acting against it. It was like an equal kind of partnership of burning off this karma. Yeah. Oh, it was horrifying, but it was also, I'm realizing now in talking about this that it left me on the doorstep of this question of Dharma.
Right.
Because the practices, you know, Ram Dass says, you know, all methods are traps. He said that before. And I think the practices I was using to get me to that finish line of that race with my small self and the higher self, if you want to call it, are complete. And so I've been kind of in this spacious land of being, I feel like maybe back in this kind of material plane that of going back to the Dharma. So I've left the emergency room, had that experience. I saw what was happening. Now there's another life. Right. And so I feel like this is the thing that, you know, another guest, Vera, De Chalambert, who was on, shared a post the other day about, you know, why can't you just live a normal life, like an ordinary life? Why do you have to have this purpose and have this thing and be this thing and, you know, be striving to this place? And it's true. Just doing your practice.
Yeah.
Cultivating these characteristics of being more kind, compassionate, loving, present human being is enough. But there is another piece of the karma that I feel is the Dolly Parton piece, the essential embodiment of that. So do you have any reflections on that?
because I think that to develop the shift in attitudes where you're not trying to promote and brand and further yourself, even if it's your spiritual self, or your higher self, the self that wants to do all that is not the self that has access to spirit or God or that level of understanding. You know, it's like that race you were talking about. You're always in that race. That was I said it was a great dream, not because it was a happy dream, because it was such a vivid image, such a vivid illustration, like this psychic snapshot of a lot of us spiritual practitioners get involved in that. And but the embodiment piece to me is the practice. So when we practice meditation, we are bringing all of ourselves to that moment. It's a quite intense thing. And people don't talk so much about the passion of it, but I feel it's actually a very passionate engagement. And yes, we get distracted because we have our habitual, you know, our tendencies and conditioning to get distracted or fall asleep. But the practice is to realize that, to wake up, and then to just pour all of ourselves into being present this moment, 100%. Arms, legs, you know, brain, heart, skin, bones, all of it. And that willingness to be present in that way. No, we can't do it every moment, but the formal practice of really immersing ourselves wholeheartedly in that, it just does. It seeps into the rest of our life. And then a figure ground shift happens where we start to notice when we're not present, instead of all the time having to remind ourselves to be present. Does that make sense?
Totally. Like, yeah, that's the inverse. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Suddenly being present is sort of the way we mostly are without even noticing it. That happened.
And then that's the other dog. It's like the dog toy. It's like that's a next toy for the ego then to start to play with. For me, in my experience. So first is be present, then it's like, oh, you weren't just not present. How, you know, then there can be a whole story that runs out on what, that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what helps with that, there's a beautiful line in the Heart Sutra, which is a Mahayana Buddhist teaching. And the line, it's talking about how when we are not living in the conceptual world, when we're in the world of direct experience, we don't really have a concept of our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. We're just experiencing, direct experience. And then there's a beautiful line, and it says, it's saying no eyes, no ears, no nose, no, you know, don't get all hung up on identification with all these things, these ideas about who and what we are. And then it says, and also no ignorance, and also no extinction of it. And that so helpful to me, of course. You know, there's no idea of ignorance and, oh my God, you know, I blew it. And like you said, another layer of judgment coming in, right? It helps us accept and allow and have some equanimity for that process where we just get to say, well, of course, we forget. That's why, you know, in Sanskrit, the word for mindfulness means basically remembering. We forget, but forgetting is part of it.
Right.
It's not a state.
It's part of the it's part of the romance. It's part of the grist for the mill. It's part of the massaging away of
this
that
process. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. You said something about the willingness, and that definitely, you know, I'm just coming out of this really intense, like 3 months of whoa. What I was really in an argument with Spirit about is what Spirit was showing me, or God, or my guru, you know, at this point I'm in new languages, Spirit, was showing me that I really wasn't willing. There was this sliver, this thing that I was not aware of that was very much, and I make this gesture of like, it felt like it was like a cord. Like a chord inside of me that, like one guitar string, that was just not going to be tuned, you know.
Yeah.
No matter what, and I was so angry about it because I thought, no effing way. I know that I've been surrendered. I know that I've been willing. You know.
Yeah.
And then it was like, here you go. We're going to crush you in this sandwich press. Until you see the cheese melt out, and then you'll see there's this thin, we crushed the whole panini and there was still some unmelted cheese in there. See, look. And it's like, well, gosh darn it, there was, you know, how did I not see that? So I'm telling all this personal stuff partially because I feel your reflection of being with a wonderful teacher and someone who's done the practice, but also to just say, what is that? Is that worth the pursuit of a life to get all that cheese melted? Sorry, it's terrible, terrible metaphor, but it's what's coming up right now. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like I feel like I can't tell for myself personally if I set myself up for this idea, and that's why this whole thing is being burnt out. Or if that really is part of the practice of awakening and surrendering and becoming more and more conscious.
I think they're both true. You set yourself up for it by deciding to do spiritual practice. You know what I mean? And once you make that choice and you enter that path, I always think of that song of John Lennon, Instant Karma. Mm-hmm. You know, once we make that, you can't really turn back. You can't unknow what you have learned. And so there's really nowhere to go except keep going forward that way. And Yes, I do think it's about melting our cheese.
I'm sorry. You know, I'll think it through. We'll come up with something different.
For one thing, it's delicious. You know, and we want to have a delicious life, right?
Yeah.
We want to have a life of happiness and joy. That's really important. And the uncooked cheese is generally not, you know, the things that aren't digested in us are the things that generally are not the things that make us happy and joyful, right? They're often the things that occlude our clarity or interfere with our ability to just enjoy life. You know, like right now, for example, in my life, this is a very blessed time. Knock on wood, everyone in the family is, you know, touch wood, they're all healthy. It's just a good time. And I know it can't last, but it makes it even more precious that it is a good time. But then that knowledge of impermanence can also kind of tip into a sort of anxiety that I think all the women in my family work with in one way or another. It's like waiting for the other shoe to drop. Oh, I'm happy now, but oh my God, what's going to happen? Something. Do you know what I mean? That kind of. So just being able to rest and relax in whatever is happening and the goodness of that is also really important. And I mean, the Buddha also said, like, don't just look at all the mountains ahead of you that you still have to climb, you know, all that uncooked cheese. He said, turn around and look at the way you've come.
Yeah.
You know, the gooey, yummy, melted, or the mountains we've already climbed. Like, really appreciate what we've done, too. Not from a place of conceit, but just of acknowledging and respecting the efforts that we've made and the insights that have been given to us and the grace of being involved in this process in the first place.
Yeah. See, and that's such a maternal, you know, way of encouragement. And I think I had a conversation recently with a Christian pastor, actually, we were talking about, you know, Jesus as this figure that was very, very maternal, was very nurturing, was very, yeah. It wasn't this masculine, feminine kind of thing, and that's kind of actually kind of contemporary idea that these things are so polarizing. But so then the Buddha is saying the same thing. Let's look, you know, look and see what you've done. Good job, you know, you got 5 A's and 1 B, and that's good. And, you know, keep going, you know. But I do think that but to your point of impermanence and this being a good time in your life now, which I'm so happy for you to be in that moment, is that these moments of intensities, of these squeezings out, these intense races,
yes,
are not constant. That they really are right there in these kind of moments to give us. I mean, this is what all the memes would tell you, right? That whatever is happening is for your growth, and this ending is this beginning, and da 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 da, which it truly is. If you're willing to take this nurturing perspective, you're willing to take this peaceful, you know, being at peace, being at rest. I don't know how you describe the opposite of the anxiety of the shoe will drop, but just being with what is in that
relaxing space,
relaxing into that moment. Then there is some space to kind of let the rest of the water run off.
And a lot of it is about trust. You know, it's very hard when we're in the squeeze. And, oh my gosh, I have been there so many times in my life, you know, really tough times. And during those times, it's difficult to trust that that it will end, that it will come out, that there's a possibility of things being even better than they were, et cetera, all those things. And I remember years and years ago having this newspaper clipping that was from it was called the Snow Lion. I think now it's a glossy magazine, but it used to be this little print newspaper that came out of Ithaca. And there was a picture of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, on the front. And he had his hands in prayer position, you know, his hands joined in namaste and gassho, and he was saying, maybe I am the last Dalai Lama. It's all right. there's nothing wrong. And I remember thinking, what? How can you say that? There's a genocide of your people going on. You this venerable and beautiful tradition may not continue. How can that be all right? And it became kind of a koan for my life. Like, what does he mean by this? And I remember having a breakup, another one, and being sitting in the zendo, tears pouring down my face. I was meditating and just like devastated. And yet, I remember the thought came. It just was an understanding. It's all right. I'm heartbroken, and it's all right because I'm not alone in my heartache. There, I am every human being who's ever had a broken heart. This is what it's like to be a human being who's heartbroken. And it's still heartbreaking. I'm still crying. And it's all right, if that makes sense. Both are true.
Yeah. And that's the value of the practice, right? Is to coming in touch with that stability, that truth, that
it's a trust.
That trust, yeah. Developing that trust in life itself. Yeah. And is there a text? Do you have a favorite text? Something that you go back to again and again?
Oh my gosh.
Or something that's really, really working with you right now that you're really digging?
Right now, the text that I'm really working with is my life. And by that, I mean, I'm trying to write. And that's not easy for me. Never has been. That's why, all my friends have written all these books and I haven't. Of course, I was being a mom and I was having a lot of very understandable distractions. But the reality is that it's just not easy for me. And so I'm not really answering your original question, except that it can be an answer for everybody, too. I'm really looking at my life in a different way with hindsight, with the perspective, the 2020 vision of looking back and being able to see, just as you were describing about your recent insights, that, oh my gosh, yes, that really did lead to this. I couldn't see it at the time, but I can see it now. So sort of like reading the story of my life with the understanding that I have today and really seeing how much that trust that I didn't always have, but how much it would have been warranted could I have had it all along. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Really understanding the lessons of this life. And I'm older too, so it feels like a time to take stock and integrate all of what it's been. It's almost like people have in a long meditation retreat, they do a kind of life review process.
Right.
Or maybe people at the end of their lives, which I don't think this is, but we never know.
There's something about the word and putting things into that form. Like, and so I appreciate you saying, when I asked you what your favorite text was, being your own words and your own writing of it, because in a way that's, very feminine.
Yes. It is.
Yeah.
It is. The real raw stuff of our life.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Absolutely. And looking at our whole life, we've been conditioned to learn about the words and experiences of others. Like, I've been reading this book or this text of this wise person. But how about the way that we have come and the wisdom that arises from our own practice? Really, that's what I more and more want to study for now.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I can't wait to get to study it, to read it when it's come through you. And I had a through this process, I often I do a lot of intuitive book shopping. So I was led to two different books during this period. One was Milarepa's 100,000 songs, or 100,000 songs, whatever it is. And have been reading that as if it was written for me in this time. And then and then this book of Inanna, the story of Inanna. And
oh, that story meant so much to me when I got divorced, when I went through that. Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's just profound. So you know, so the teacher, so it's almost as if that was given to me. It was a gift for me in a time when I wasn't able to write my own words, when I didn't have the space to reflect and have that hindsight, the space, the spaciousness, the presence. Those were presented to me. And I just think I want people to trust that more, you know, and I know that my teacher Ram Dass encourages people to do that, encourages them to listen and to practice listening. But then, okay, circling around, and I know we have to end soon, but this comes back to...
Ram Dass is wonderful for that.
Right. He's very much trust your path. So,
yep.
But now for the practice of Dharma, you have, you know, what is your experience in working with people who play the spiritual field? I don't know what my neighbor's dog is having a freak out. Sorry.
I guess I feel like a lot of my work is about helping people connect with and have access to their own power, the power of love in their own hearts, and the power to imagine a life that can be theirs. And so, because everybody has this possibility, but people helped me find it in myself. I didn't do that all by myself, you know, and I think we need each other to see. Like, I can see qualities about you that you, when you look in the mirror, don't see. We need each other for that. So in my work with people, I mean, there's no one size fits all, you know, everybody's wired differently. And that's part of what I love about working with people, is the intimacy, beginning to discover, you know, how it is for you, or how, you know, what will resonate with you, what will give you more access to your own beauty and wisdom and power of love.
Right. So it is really individual. I guess I have and I appreciate that so much. And I guess I have some sort of fantasy or desire to have something that is just a fail-safe that just never changes in terms of a spiritual practice. And at least over the last, I say I started in earnest 10 years ago, but I've always been a seeker, if you will.
Yeah.
But just in the last, say, 10 years of earnest practice, you know, that has shifted probably 3 or 4 times. And now I'm finding myself in another place where I'm looking for a different practice. And I'm just getting your reflections on that. Like, in terms of,
practice that really is one that you can thread through everything, and that is fail safe. And it's what you're asking about. It's your teacher's practice of loving awareness. It's Ram Dass, our teacher, all of us. You know, when he teaches that meditation where he just puts his hand on his heart and says, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. And he's suggesting that we use it almost like a mantra or a blessing, a reminder that who I am, I can identify with something much bigger than the usual narratives about who I am that I get caught in, right? And so I would say that is fail safe. Loving awareness is always a place for us to turn and can always transform our experience. Maybe not, you know, instantly when we want it to happen, but if we stay with it, and this is the beauty of practice, I mean, we have to have a longer view of our life and the trajectory of it, this journey that we're all on together, you know, and we have that longer view. To me, that's one dimension of loving awareness, is seeing it's bigger than any one period in our life or any one crisis or any one loss of faith, or the things we go through, right?
Correct. Right, exactly. And so then that then kind of wraps in this idea of purpose and dharma, is that not everybody's dharma is a spiritual path, but a spiritual path practicing the dharma will feed your other path, your whatever.
Absolutely. Right. And if you don't have a purpose, it will become clear
through the practicing of the dharma.
Yes, and if you get too caught up in being all identified with your purpose and outcome, and, you know, well, that won't work. And then you'll get the feedback of how painful that is. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And then you have this returning to cultivating the space, the awareness, the presence, the kindness, the compassion.
Yeah.
And that awe of the whole going on, being fine, being okay.
I love that you use the word awe, because it comes back to the beginning of our conversation where you were saying, well, ordinary isn't really ordinary. Yeah. Ordinary is filled with awe.
Yes.
Thank you for that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So, okay, well, so I ask everybody to give a specific piece of advice to women and girls on the spiritual path. So I'll put that to you. You've given a lot of wisdom already.
So the advice that I would give to women and to girls is trust your perceptions, trust yourself, have confidence in who you are. Don't apologize for who you are. Trust the goodness of who you are. And that will help you trust. That encourages your intuition, the gifts that, as females, you know, we really do have to come forth when we are trusting who we are and trusting our perceptions,
right?
Especially the girls.
And how do you say that, or how do you perceive that a spiritual practice inspires that confidence? Or what are some specific spiritual practices or that you think inspire confidence?
I think that mindfulness, just being very concretely present, you know, feet on the floor, awareness of the body, just simple awareness practices, gives you confidence in where you are, and because you can always ground in that and your present location. I also think that being aware of the messages, girls being aware of the messages that they're getting from the culture that start to not match who they feel they are inside, that being aware of, say, the spiritual ideals or aspirations versus what the culture, which is so immersed in total materialism and consumerism, is telling us. Being aware of that helps, I think, stay with what's true for us and not be constantly swayed by, you know, entertainment and having to be beauty or that we should be a celebrity or, you know, all the things that are the messages, especially that folks are getting, you know.
Right. So being really mindful of your environment and of your body in time helps you to kind of, it's almost like creating the structure for that space in your heart for you to stay connected to that confidence, that truth, that your own truth. Right.
Exactly.
And so it does require some spiritual structure in a way, where you're using your mind and your awareness and your attention to contain yourself, contain your world.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think you definitely need methodologies like mindfulness practice, not to be strictly bound to a specific, but we need some structured practices, and we need each other. We need to go for refuge in community. Other girls who are sympathetic, and women who can be good mentors for girls and support them in really trusting who they are and the goodness of that. We can't do it alone. We can't. We really need each other. And our skills in relationship can, as females, that we are more conditioned to be skillful at relationship, can really help us and can help us support each other as opposed to compete with each other, but really support each other. But you're right. We need a structure and we need a community.
Do you think there is somewhere for everyone to go to get that?
I do. I mean, we're not going to all find it in the same place, but
yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I really do. I feel like there's such a, and also at this time in history, we have access to so many different teachings from different traditions. Mm-hmm. And while that might be overwhelming and distracting in some ways, it's also fantastic because everybody can find what they're drawn to. And that may change over a lifetime too.
Right, right. And it just seems to me like the aspect of spirituality and community is something that you guys got because you all got it kind of together at the same time. It feels like your generation, there was this nice chunk of you that got kind of all pulled into it together in this community of, it was kind of a subculture. And now it's so, like you said, so diverse that it does require a little bit of effort to choose.
Yeah, you know, we also have each other and the wisdom of our experience that we can share. You know, this worked for me. You might try it. That kind of feeling. And you know, it didn't feel that way at the time. I can see that it looks like that when you look back at our time.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel that way.
No.
I felt very alone and messed up. I felt totally, you know?
Right.
I didn't feel like, oh, I'm being drawn with my cohort into. It didn't feel like.
No. It just looks. It's a nice picture. It's a nice painted picture of the summary. Now, for those of you that stay together and, you know, or that found each other and just continue to stay close, it really looks that way now.
Yes, and it feels that way now.
Right, yeah. right. So in you that, know, yeah.
But a lot of us are also committed to mentoring and sharing. I mean, we wouldn't be teaching otherwise, you know. And so, yeah, there's quite a few, I think, more and more great examples of women, empowered women who really care about the next generations and want to share what they've learned.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's wonderful. Well, I really so appreciate this time with you, Trudy, and I think we have more to talk about and definitely can get into some more specific topics, but I wanted to just meet with you and have a chat, learn a little bit more about you, share you with the Shakti Hour, what do you have coming up? Do you have any events or classes or workshops coming up?
Oh, I just finished a teaching marathon from Mexico to Wisdom 2.0 to retreat with my beloved friends, Anam Tipton and Norman Fisher. And what I have coming up, yes, there are retreats and things in the future. They're all on my website, which is trudygoodman.org or insidela.org, which is our nonprofit that I founded in Los Angeles. But in the next month, what I have coming up is the ability to, I've stepped back from teaching for a month and I'm going to try to write. So wish me luck.
Wish you great luck and so much ease of reading your favorite text over the next few weeks.
And although it's completely narcissistic, but I hope you understand.
No, it doesn't sound the way at all. And it sounded very, very smart.
I've done this. I'm so excited to have this time. And I guess the other thing is just that I want to acknowledge all the people at Inside LA, the community, the people who've come to join me there for helping to create something that has become a vehicle to do exactly what we're talking about, which is to share our own spiritual practice in different ways through different people, to see, who can benefit, and including with veterans and homeless people and, people experiencing all kinds of really pretty terrible life challenges, not just those of us who are reasonably comfortable with our food, clothing, and shelter,
Right.
So I just want to give a shout out to everybody who's helped make that happen. I'm really proud of who we are today.
Fantastic. So everybody check out Insight LA and Trudy's website to get on board. It's only a month, so by the time it's springtime, there'll be plenty of events, chances to catch you. And
so thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Lovely to meet you.
Totally.